Hello again, I'm Orman Alney. This podcast is about health care. It's also about health. Is it time for a different kind of medical practice proven to produce better outcomes at lower cost? That's later on. First, the politics. The focus for years has been on Obamacare, the target of Republicans ever since it was enacted. Despite control of both the White House and Congress, they have failed to repeal it, but they are chipping away. Here's President Trump.
In a few moments, I will sign an executive order taking the first steps to providing millions of Americans with Obamacare relief.
With some Democrats, though, demanding universal health care and Medicare for all, this is bound to become a major issue in this November's off-year elections. Recently, President Trump's new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, announced a set of objectives.
This administration and this president are not interested in incremental steps. We are unafraid of disrupting existing arrangements simply because they're backed by powerful special interests.
We'll start today's progress report on health care with Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and it's good to have you back on our podcast.
It's great to be here.
We heard two members of the Trump administration, the president and his Secretary of Health and Human Services. Are they in line? Are they consistent in what they're saying?
They are, because they're talking about greater flexibility for consumers, greater access to medical records. That's what Alex Azar was talking about that yesterday. And, of course, he's the newly installed Secretary of Health and Human Services. They want to increase transparency in healthcare. They want to give consumers more choice. But with some of these choices, you may not have the comprehensiveness of plans offered in the Affordable Care Act. And that is one of the biggest changes that we're seeing.
The goals, though, when you talk about access to records and transparency and choice, sound like Obama.
They do, and the Obama administration certainly wanted the same kind of access to your medical record, your ability to share that medical record, more transparency in healthcare, trying to figure out when we can, like in a non-emergency situation for healthcare, figure out how much a particular test or treatment would cost, the idea of testing some new payment models and giving Medicare the authority to spread those new payment models across the country if they worked. The difference here would be, Alex Azar was talking yesterday about reducing government burden. So I'm assuming he means some of the regulatory hurdles that some may see to providing health care. But yes, some of these goals are very similar to what the Obama administration was acting on. But of course, with the Trump administration, the focus is to lift, in their words, regulatory burdens. So that's what we have to watch.
That's what Obamacare relief means?
To some, Obamacare relief means that. But to others, looking at changing the playing field, if you will, with the Affordable Care Act, the goal was to take, to have no matter where you live, to be able to get the same kind of coverage in the individual market. Many of the initiatives of the Trump administration under the umbrella of flexibility may mean you don't get a plan that is as comprehensive. It may mean that you couldn't get health insurance based on pre-existing condition, or you would have to pay more. A lot of the rules of the road, if you will, in Obamacare would be lifted in some of the steps that the Trump administration is moving on.
The Trump administration also wants to give the states more choice. Isn't that correct? And more options?
That's absolutely correct. There in Idaho, for example, state insurance officials are telling insurers they can ignore the Affordable Care Act. That's a development. This idea of these short-term health plans under the Affordable Care Act, they could only be offered for a 90-day period. Now those might go to an entire year. This idea of association health plans allowing members of a particular trade group, no matter where they are, to get the same kind of health plan. But again, the key thing for those elements is for these plans is that they don't have some of the protections in the Affordable Care Act. There's not a guaranteed issue that they have to cover you no matter what your health status. They may not necessarily have the annual or the lifetime limits. They may not have the essential health benefits. That's the 10 categories of coverage that had to be standardized in every plan. And to be sure, critics of the Affordable Care Act welcome this because they have argued that the insurance under Obamacare is too comprehensive and too expensive. But for consumers, may find that some of these plans, while they are cheaper, especially in the premiums, the monthly premiums, depending on what they cover, you might be on the hook for more. So this is really a major turn in where we were. We're kind of going back to where the individual market was before the Affordable Care Act became law in 2010. What you paid, what was covered, really depended on what was available where you lived. And now that kind of floor is going to be changed. I think conservative states are going to go with these less generous plans. They want them offered. The insurance commissioners will welcome them, the state legislatures. In more blue states where they've really welcomed and embraced the Affordable Care Act, like a California or a Maryland, they will want to keep the more comprehensive plans. Some of these states are working on making basically reinstating a kind of penalty system done differently if you don't for the individual mandate penalty that's being lifted next year. So the red states, the blue states may be taking very different twists and turns in the years ahead.
Back to electoral politics, a lot of Democrats are echoing what we have heard so often from Bernie Sanders.
What astounds me is that we already have a pretty good majority of the American people who believe in universal health care. And we've reached that stage with media not talking about the issue at all. So my strong belief is that most Americans do not know that in virtually every other country on earth, not only is healthcare considered a right with limited out-of-pocket or no out-of-pocket expenses, but the same thing in many cases applies to higher education or to childcare.
So some media may not be talking about it, but we are talking about it on our podcast. Nobody expects universal health care to happen anytime soon, or even Medicare for all, which Sanders and others have called for. But one think tank with ties to the Democratic Party has proposed what could become Medicare for most. That's according to Michael Hilsick. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning business columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Good to have you.
Good to be here.
Tell us about Medicare for most, and in what ways does it contrast with what we just heard about what it is that the Republicans and the Trump administration are trying to do?
Sure. Well, this is the Center for American Progress. It's a progressive think tank. It's closely associated with the Democratic Party, of course. The center's proposal, it calls it Medicare Extra for All. It's sort of a step toward what Sanders has been talking about. He's been talking about Medicare for All, that is just opening up our Medicare system to all comers. The center has a somewhat more nuanced approach, but over time, if this were to be implemented, over time, most people, I think, would be on Medicare or something like it. The center would say, we're going to enroll all newborns in Medicare Extra. We are going to enroll, of course, the over 65 population in Medicare Extra. They're already on Medicare. Anyone who is uninsured would be automatically enrolled in Medicare Extra. So over time, you would see that eventually this program would take over. Employers would have the choice. They could either keep their existing plans, or they could transition their employees to this new plan. And it's got a lot of elements that I think address some of the problems that we see in going whole hog towards single payer right away. It's more incremental. It's going to be somewhat cheaper. It exploits the administrative advantages that we see in Medicare in, I think, some very clever ways. And it also addresses some of the flaws that we know about in Obamacare. And I think that's also very important.
The Center for American Progress is an important think tank. That's where politicians of both parties get their ideas often from think tanks. That's been true for a long time. Does it appear that Democrats are in any way likely to organize around this particular plan as we go forward in the elections, or are they that much together?
I think they're certainly going to organize around the concept of universal health care. And there are many commentators who've looked at the political landscape that we're going to see over the next 6 months, 9 months, over perhaps the next couple of years, are saying that it's in the Democrats' interest to be much more aggressive about this than they've been in the past. A few years ago, when Obamacare was first enacted, a lot of Democrats ran away from it. They were nervous about the opposition that was created by the Republican Party. They were nervous about the skepticism that members of the public were showing toward the Affordable Care Act. Now we see that the Affordable Care Act actually is very popular. Its approval rating is now over 50%. And I think the damage that the Trump administration has done and has been trying to do to the Affordable Care Act has finally registered with a lot of voters. That accounts for why Obamacare's popularity is increasing. And I think that's giving Democrats a lot more spine when they go into the campaign to say, we are going to finally bring you health care reform that works for everybody. Now, what actual proposals they're going to coalesce around, it's hard to say. Maybe they won't coalesce around anything specific. But I think running on the idea that we are going to protect your health care and the Republicans are trying to undermine it is going to be a very powerful message.
So you tend, it sounds to me, to be favorable toward Obamacare, toward the approach that the Democrats have taken and that they want to take in the future.
Well, I don't think there's any question that Obamacare has been a boon for millions of Americans. It's brought health coverage to 20 million Americans who did not have it before. It's not perfect. There's certainly segments of society who are paying more for their health coverage, maybe have even been priced out of the market. I think we can trace that to some of the particular elements of the subsidy pattern under the Affordable Care Act. And in fact, Medicare Extra for All addresses that specifically in a way that I think many healthcare reformists think is the right way to go. They're basically going to say you will get a subsidy no matter what your income is if your only available insurance is going to cost you more than 10% of your income. That removes this cliff that we had in the Affordable Care Act, where if you earned a dollar over 400% of the federal poverty line, you were excluded from all subsidies. That was very damaging to, I think, a lot of people in the middle class and even the upper middle class. Medicare Extra for All will remove that cliff, and that's going to be a boon, I think. That will bring in many, many more millions of people into the health care system.
Will remove it if, in fact, it gets enacted, and it would take a Democratic control
of
the Congress, of course, in order to do that. Michael Hiltzik, again, business columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News. Important to point out, yours is a nonpartisan health research group. But how did the Republicans respond to some of the advantages of Obamacare that Michael Hiltzik just laid out?
I think Republicans would argue that while it's a great idea to cover more people, this is not necessarily the way to go, this being Obamacare, because it is fairly prescriptive. And again, as we discussed earlier, that was done with intention, because the individual market had always been the most problematic for people. If you had a pre-existing medical condition, you wouldn't get insurance. It would cost you through the roof. Obamacare tried to smooth out those bumps in the road, if you will, and offer more standardized benefit package. And Republicans have really said that's not one size doesn't fit all here. But one thing that's, I think, interesting about the Center for American Progress plan, as Michael noted, it tries to fix a lot of problems and issues, especially with this subsidy issue, where if in the Affordable Care Act, you make over 400% of poverty, that's about $45,000 a year, you get nothing for a subsidy. And so those premium hits are really, if they increase, which they have to some extent, that really, really hurts you. But the thing that strikes me about this plan is that you look at Obamacare and you look at the market it was intended to go after, the individual market, about 10 million people. And it did have an expansion of the Medicaid program, which has helped millions of people. But think about when we look at our healthcare system, we have 152 million people or so in the employer market, about another 130 million under Medicare and Medicaid. There's some in VA and TRICARE. The Affordable Care Act was really aimed at that individual market, 10 million or so, and it was a huge fight in Congress for the last 8 years. All the attempts in the House from Republicans to repeal all or part of the law, the big fight we had in the Senate over the summer to repeal it. I think a plan as comprehensive as CAHPS, Medicare, you know, Medicare Extra plan, would face so many fights. I mean, you'd have to have Democrats with more than 60 in the Senate, way north of 218 in the House, which is what you need to pass something, and they'd all have to be on the same page. And of course, we've seen that when either party gets control, they start to sort of splinter and fracture. So while the aspirations of the CAP plan, I think a lot of people look at and like, the actually getting it there, getting it done, the political wrangling would be huge.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Once again, we're talking about healthcare, which seems enormously complicated, as do the various proposals that have been made to lower costs. Three billionaires have come up with a plan, or at least they say they have. Michael Hiltzik, tell us about that.
Sure. Well, they're Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Warren Buffett, who everybody knows is this great investor, and Jamie Dimon, who is the chairman and CEO of J.P. Morgan. And they came out at the end of January with this tripartite announcement that they were going to take on the problem of rising healthcare costs in the United States. And everybody said, well, these are three billionaires. They're very successful. They know what they're doing. This is a big breakthrough. But the fact of the matter is that they didn't actually propose anything. They put out a press release saying, you know, we're going to set something up among the three of us or among our three companies, and it's going to work some sort of magic. They did say we're going to look at technology solutions to the healthcare cost mystery. Now, I think if you really look at what they said and what they were talking about, I think they did a great disservice, in fact, to the American public, because they were communicating this notion that reducing healthcare costs or bringing prices down was a mystery that had to be solved. And the fact of the matter is, everybody knows how to do it. The United States is the only country in the world, the only industrialized country that has healthcare costs on this level. The rest of the industrialized world spends half as much as we do as a percentage of gross domestic product on their healthcare. They know how to do it. We know how to do it. And the answer is, as I quoted a paper from some years ago by the late Uwe Reinhardt and two colleagues, it's the prices, stupid. We pay too much for our hospital care, we pay much too much for our pharmaceuticals, we pay doctors, particularly specialists, too much, and we pay insurance companies too much. If you strip all those costs out, you begin to get to a solution to how to bring prices. If you strip those prices out, you get to a solution to how to bring costs down. There's no real mystery about it, and the idea that there's some software platform or technology out there that's going to be a magic bullet is really, I think, a distraction and a mistake. All of these other countries, Great Britain, Canada, Germany, Switzerland, France, they're all much more successful at controlling costs. They don't have any different software from we do. They don't have any different technology from what we have. They just have lower prices for providers and physicians and drugs. That's the key. And that's what Bezos, Buffett, and Dimon should really be focusing on, is how to extract these costs out of the prices we pay.
So, Mary Agnes Carey, what we heard from the Health and Human Services Director, Mr. Azar, earlier was that's exactly what the Trump administration wants to do. Does it have a sensible and reasonable way of accomplishing them?
I think we have to see what they come up with, but I think Michael hits it right on the head. Short of setting prices, short of the United States of America deciding we are going to decide as a nation how much prices can increase, what we're paying for everything, a lot of the gamesmanship, if you will, that's still there, that's in the current healthcare system in pricing, negotiations, what you make public, what you don't make public will still be there. Look, everybody loves the idea of great technology. I love the idea that the portal at my pediatrician's office could be easily shared with the specialist my kid has to see. But I know 9 times out of 10, that's not the case. They're different medical portals, right? So for Alex Azar or the president or anyone to get up and say, we want to have every Medicare beneficiary, every person in healthcare should be able to have complete control over their healthcare record and share it with everyone, which would save tons of time and money. That's great, but really, really hard to get to. Being able to understand what the price of a particular test is so I as a consumer can make a decision about who provides that test, how good they are at it, how many has that particular facility done, how much is it going to cost me, that is all great. But the burdens to that, and frankly, I think the spending on common infrastructure for health IT to be spent is huge. And so, I mean, I've heard this stuff in healthcare for years about shareable medical technology and changing incentives and this kind of stuff. And the idea that I, as a consumer, that my shopping power in healthcare is going to bring down prices. I mean, maybe if I had all the information I need, but a lot of that is purposefully kept secret because hospitals are negotiating with the insurance companies or the drug makers are keeping some data, you know, private or you name it, that it's just not out there getting us to the point where that's there and we can use it and deciding whether or not we have the political will to set prices. Those are all ginormous steps to take to get to the goals we all want to have.
Let me ask you both about the way in which we provide health care. And let's focus for a moment on what happens at the end of life and the extraordinary amount that we spend, as opposed to others, on that period of time. Michael Hilsig, you go first.
Well, sure. Yes, we know the end of life. Actually, I think people in their 70s, late 60s, 70s, they are the most expensive patients. They're just entering Medicare. They end up having a lot of procedures. If they get through that period, I think their general spending goes down. And I'm leaving aside things like long-term care, Alzheimer's care, nursing home care, that sort of thing. In other countries, in some other countries, we find a much more rigorous approach to some of the procedures that we approve or that we undergo in this country routinely. In Great Britain, you have a whole agency that makes judgments about whether a certain procedure or a device or a drug is suitable for the country to pay for based on how many years of high quality life it's going to produce and at what cost. And I think in a country like Britain that's got a national health system, if an 80-year-old or an 85-year-old goes in and is a candidate for some sort of major intervention, musculoskeletal intervention, what have you, they're likely to say, we're not going to pay for it.
So, Marietta Gittes-Carey, that sounds to a lot of people like rationing.
Well, it can be when you look at it through that particular idea of a board making that decision. But here's the thing that I think is changing from watching this, and we've done a ton of reporting about this at Kaiser Health News, that the national conversation about healthcare at the end of life, I believe, is changing. Let's go back to before the Affordable Care Act was passed. All that was in the law, which is now actually happening in doctors' offices, was allowing physicians in Medicare to get reimbursed to talk to people about their end-of-life care options. Their options, right? That was the whole death panel thing that came up. Well, that blew over, and now doctors and patients all over the country are utilizing that consultation with their doctors, and they're talking about it. The incentives in the healthcare system are almost always to do more, right? Put a pacemaker in a 90-year-old, 95-year-old that's already got other comorbidities, but go ahead, you'll get paid for it, so do it. Do colonoscopies on people that are advanced age. Perhaps their chances of getting colon cancer are fairly low, but you're going to get paid for it. We have to change those incentives that are in the medical system, and we have to have, I believe, families talk about this as we all age. What sort of end of life do we want? Do we want to be at home? Do we want to be in the hospital? How much care, if you've got a particular medical condition, how much care do you want? When does it stop? These are really, really hard conversations to have. But that is one of the critical turning points to changing how end-of-life care is done in this country, because as we have it now, there are a lot of incentives for the medical system to just provide more, more, and more.
So, Michael Hiltzik, one of the things you said about, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you said one of the things about the Center for American Progress report is that it might not be objected to by the hospitals, the doctors, the drug companies, and the others that are involved. Why not?
Well, I think you always have this balance when you're talking about providers between the access that they have to a larger population of customers, that is to say, patients, and the price they're going to be paid per patient and under what circumstances. But I did want to sort of add a gloss to what Mary Agnes was just saying about end-of-life care. I think I can tell you from sort of personal family experience that as families, we don't really have a protocol or protocols for how we treat members of the family who are entering this stage of their lives. Families that are used to having discussions as a unit find it very hard to make decisions about what sort of care to provide for a member who is suffering Alzheimer's or just old age or needs some sort of procedure. It's very, very hard, and I think American families haven't, as Mary Agnes sort of alluded to, haven't really gotten their arms around what the protocol is, how we should make these decisions, and who should help us make these decisions. And the fact that under the Affordable Care Act, physicians were encouraged to facilitate these sorts of discussions and these sorts of decisions was one of the good things about the Affordable Care Act that sort of got drummed out of the system by the talk of death panels and rationing and what have you. So it's difficult. But once again, I mean, going back to your original question, I think providers, drug companies, hospitals, they are all going to be really on the fence about how payments are distributed between them and among them. And that is going to be a very difficult discussion to have.
A difficult discussion, Mary Agnes Kelly, also an issue of the market versus the government.
Right. I mean, when the incentives are to provide care and you will get paid to provide care, then you will provide care. But Michael's right. I mean, look, it's not, you see these campaigns in Medicare for when families get together around Thanksgiving or Christmas and just sit down and have a conversation with your parents or your grandparents. Those aren't comfortable and those aren't great. But I can attest from my own personal experience with my mother having those kind of conversations before her illness got worse. We gave her as a family, the death she wanted. She told us she didn't want any more medical care. We got everybody ready for that. She died at home. And I know it's hard to expect parents, people to do that, siblings to agree, kids to talk to parents, getting parents to talk about it. But I really think it is the turning point to how we take care of all of us in our later years. And I mean, look at the demographics. We've got 11,000 people a day aging into Medicare. The older population is going to grow and grow and grow. And as a country, we have to look at end-of-life care and how we provide it and how we do it and just have that conversation. I think it is turning. Michael's right. It's really hard to do. It's evolving. But I think we're getting a lot closer than we were 10 years ago.
So we've covered a lot of issues. Last question to both of you, starting with Michael Hiltzik. Are we going to see anything change significantly between now and the end of this year or early next year, depending, I suppose, on who wins in Congress? Or are we inevitably going to continue these kinds of arguments for a long time to come?
Well, I think between now and the end of the year, we are really on the verge of entering into campaign season. We're not going to see much change. We may see some ideas come out and coalesce, and I think we're going to see a very different approach, as we've been talking about, between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans are going to be talking about cutting up, reducing costs by providing more what I would call junk coverage, junk insurance to the population. We are seeing in Idaho a drastic proposal to basically open that state's market to really crummy insurance because it's cheaper. after the election, if the Democrats control one or both houses, I think we're going to see much more specific proposals coming out, much more focused discussions. But it's still going to take it's going to take years. It's going to take years to settle on something, and then it's going to take years after that to actually implement any reforms that emerge from the political system.
Mary Agnes Carey?
What I think is what is watching is not so much near the end of the year, but what happens next year when people no longer have to pay a penalty for not having health insurance. What does that do to premiums in the Affordable Care Act? What happens when people go into these short-term plans or the association health plans that don't meet all the parameters of the Affordable Care Act? I'm sure we're going to be writing stories about people say, I thought I had this coverage. I don't have that coverage. What happens to them? And let's not forget about watching Medicaid. There's a lot of flexibility now with the Trump administration for work requirements, for to having Medicaid beneficiaries pay premiums. How do those play out? Because one, I think, of the untold, you know, sort of untold stories of the Affordable Care Act is it actually improved public support for the Medicaid program, because as Republicans look to block grant it and spend less, people began to realize Medicaid is two-thirds of nursing home care. It's half of all the births in this country that many people they might know personally, even members of their family, were on that program. So I look out more towards the next presidential cycle. What are the effects of these changes the Trump administration wants to implement, and how do voters respond?
Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News, Michael Hiltzik with the Los Angeles Times. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've heard a progress report on Obamacare. It won't be repealed, but it is evolving from state to state for better or worse. But one veteran doctor and medical school professor says we've got it all wrong. Instead of focusing on the cost of health care, we need to focus on health. He's Wayne Jonas, practicing GP in Virginia, executive director of the Samueli Integrative Health Programs, and a researcher at the National Institutes of Health. And the title of his book says it all, How Healing Works, Get Well and Stay Well Using Your Hidden Power to Heal. Dr. Jonas, welcome.
Thank you, Warren. It's good to be on your show.
You have written as follows: our healthcare system is obsessed with delivering medical services, performing procedures, prescribing medications. It really needs to become obsessed with producing health. What do you mean?
Well, we are that. I mean, I have practiced as a mainstream conventional doctor in a system that provides platinum-level health care for all of the people that come and see me, and that's in the military. And they have full access to full health care. And what I can do really well in that system is that I can keep you alive and I can keep you functioning. But the data shows that when it comes to chronic disease prevention, management, or reversal, I'm not very good at it. And if everybody in the country had platinum-level health care like that, it's been shown that it would only actually improve the population of the health about 15 to 20%. And that's because the medical health care profession itself, what we do in the doctor's office, leaves about 80% of the underlying determinants of health on the table. And that's what we need to get to if we want a healthcare system that's actually producing health. We need to bring those into the discussion and into focus.
What do you mean 80% of the determinants are left on the table?
Well, we know now, for example, that with chronic disease, and I'm not talking about if you have a heart attack or you get in a car accident or you need, you know, a knee replacement. We're excellent at that. But for the vast majority of chronic illnesses, obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular risk factors, stroke, even dementia and Alzheimer's disease, a good chunk of that, probably estimates range from 60 to 70%, are due to behavior and the social and environmental determinants. These are things that happen outside of the doctor's office. This is how you eat, what stress you're under, how you move, how much sleep you get. And whether you live in a safe environment, whether you have you know, enough resources to access good food and have a good social support system. these things contribute the rest of health. They both prevent and treat other conditions. And yet when you go in your doctor's office, rarely do they ask about those things. They might point you in that direction, but we don't have a system that actually assists people to making them a regular part of their life.
Why don't we?
Well, because, you know, the system that we deliver today was developed about 100 years ago when we had different needs. 100 years ago, the sort of rescue-type medicine that we have today was needed. People were dying then of infectious diseases. They were dying of the consequences of trauma that were produced because we didn't know how to deal with them. And they were dying of things that public health, like vaccines and sanitary water and everything, could take care of. And so that system worked so well that we now have an aging population that has a whole different set of illnesses. And these are called chronic illnesses, the kind that I just described and listed. And they are complex, multifactorial, and you can't take care of those using sort of a pill and procedure, late stage type of approach. And so we sort of created our own problem by being so successful with an acute care system. We now need to build a chronic care system, and we haven't done that.
Well, you talk about behavior and social milieu and environment in general. How and why can doctors get involved with that?
Well, doctors do this all the time because the science actually is so compelling in these areas that they're inundated and they know, for example, that smoking, drugs, behavior, sleep, exercise, and a diet all have a huge impact on the chronic diseases they see every day. And so they are involved in it, but usually they don't operate in a system that pays for nor provides them with the training and skills that is necessary in order to really assist patients in making those kinds of behavioral changes. They'll say, gee, you should have a better diet, or you should exercise more, you should sleep more. But then they don't actually have and work with teams that actually allow that to be implemented within a patient's life. And so the behavioral changes don't occur, and then they get frustrated, and they call it a compliance problem, right? Why aren't patients able to do that? And that creates sort of a negative environment for the interaction when it comes to that. We need to build a system that actually supports patients and is designed specifically to do that and trains doctors and trains healthcare professionals how to do that.
Before we get into potential systems that might replace what we have or add to it, tell us what happens with medical students from when they first come into medical school to when they get their degrees.
Well, medical students are selected primarily for their scientific and academic expertise and capacity. They got to be smart, and they got to be especially smart in the scientific areas, biochemistry, physiology, anatomy, that type of thing. We don't select students for their psychosocial skills, and yet when they get out into the real world of practice, psychosocial skills are tantamount for delivering of good health care. Communication between the patient and the doctor, empathy, the ability to listen and ask questions and to support the patient in their health care, to have empathy, like I said, is key. And they've shown that not only do we not select individuals based on that, but then we sort of drum it out of them. Studies have shown repeatedly that young, enthusiastic medical students start with very high levels of empathy. They're ready to be healers, ready to listen, ready to deliver patient-centered care. And every year that they're in medical school, their empathy capacity gets less and less and less. So by the time they get out into real-world practice, most of it's been drummed out of them.
Is that just from dealing with cadavers, or does it have something more stronger than that?
Well, we don't have built into medical education what we say they should be practicing when they get out into practice, and that's called patient-centered care. You know, it's been known for a couple decades now when the National Academy of Medicine put out its report called Crossing the Quality Chasm that relationships, the ability to manage relationships, to put the patient in the center, to ask what matters to the patient, not just what's the matter with the patient, should be the formative aspect of how health care is delivered, especially in primary care. But we haven't actually created a system that pays for that and trains doctors how to do that and rewards doctors for going into professions that do that instead of things that reward them for, you know, financially and otherwise for doing pills and procedures.
How do you put a price on what you're talking about, the kind of empathy that you want to see doctors exhibiting?
Well, you know, we have lots of data to show that individuals that put relationship-centered care, put the patient in the middle, and create teams that work together rather than the doctor, you know, giving the orders and everybody else simply carrying them out, work better. And I describe several examples of this in my book, but many of the things are out there. The Peterson Foundation, for example, a couple years ago, commissioned researchers at Stanford to go around the country and look at the top 5% of primary care practices that meet what's called the triple aim. The triple aim is low cost, good population outcomes, good outcomes in their population, and improved quality. Improved quality. So those are the three things they looked at, the top 5%. And what they found is that the key factors that were characteristic across all of those practices was the ability to communicate, to bring the patient into the middle of the discussion so they were part of the team, ask them what matters, to work carefully with specialists to make sure that specialty care wasn't overdone but was appropriately done. It was really about relationships. And there are several examples of systems out there that have embraced this, and they have consistently shown that if you do that year after year, you lower costs, you improve outcomes in chronic illnesses, and people like working there. They enjoy it. Burnout and satisfaction are better.
Burnout. Tell us more about burnout.
Well, burnout is a huge problem. And boy, if I'm a patient and I know that when I walk into a doctor's office, in some cases I have up to a 50% chance of encountering a doctor who is burnt out. That means they're apathetic. They've lost their empathy. They really can't listen to you. Then I'd be scared about that. I'd be nervous about that. It means they can't actually hear me, and I'm not sure if they're going to be making the right decisions. And that's what we find now in primary care. We find that, for example, emergency room doctors, primary care doctors, nurses, for example, are reaching 40 and 50% burnout rates where they're just apathetic about their care. And the reason is, the underlying reason is that the volume of the patients that they need to see in order to maintain the economic components and the requirements, the administrative requirements now, for example, electronic medical records and documentation, are taking over the healing relationship, taking over this listening component that is the characteristic and the core of patient-centered care. And they know that. And that's not why they went into healthcare and went into medicine. And so the system is sort of beating them down.
There are, and I don't want to use the wrong stereotype here, but there certainly are many examples, I think all of us have probably run into them, of doctors who seem very arrogant, very materialistic, I guess you could say, and tend to be boastful about their possessions, where they live, the yachts that they sell, and that sort of thing. How do you get that out of the system and replace it with the kind of empathy and regard for real hearing and health that you're emphasizing?
Well, you know, there's always people within any profession that are in it for the money and are also going to be arrogant and boastful. And you find me a profession that doesn't have some people in that area. Hey, tell me where we all should be, right? And so that may get some press, but if you look at the vast majority, especially primary care, these are the people that have, you know, that are on the front lines, the boots on the ground people. The vast majority of them actually are not in that category. They drive modest cars. They have modest homes. They have actually declining incomes compared to what they used to have. And they're not in it necessarily for the money. They want to make sure they have a good income, of course, as everybody does. But they really want to be able to practice in a way that provides the kinds of outcomes and satisfaction that they went into medical care from. I mean, external motivation for anybody only goes so far and only for a few people. It's the intrinsic motivation that really drives sustainable behavior. And we need to have both, obviously. But I think the majority of physicians and the majority of healthcare practitioners are there because they want to be healers, and the system doesn't allow them to do it anymore.
Earlier in the program, we talked with people who raised the question of the focus that we have on end-of-life care and how much of the medical system that uses up, if you will, or how much of it is focused there. Tell us a little bit about that, and would the kind of approach that you're proposing change that situation?
It would. You know, the statistic that you always hear is that 5% of the population with advanced illness is taking up 50% of the healthcare budget. And these are individuals that have chronic end-stage or complicated conditions. They're not all just at the end of life. Some of them have what we call advanced illness that require lots of interventions, lots of medications, lots of specialists, and these take up a huge amount of care. Now, this is the top of the cost pyramid, and this is where you see most of the attempts to reduce cost focused on, trying to reduce, you know, the kinds of procedures and hospitalizations and expensive approaches that these take. But remember that 95% of us are headed in that direction. And what we don't have, is that we don't have anything that's preventing that from getting into the 5%. And so what I call integrative health, what's at the top is the 5% is integrated, but the integrative health that brings these determinants of health that I mentioned before into the picture, into an effective delivery system, would slow down and in some cases reverse the 95% that are marching towards that 5%. So the point is that if we want to have long-term reductions in costs and sustainable reductions, we can't just focus on the 5%. We have to focus on the 95% that are going that direction if we don't engage in prevention and some type of a program that reverses those who are at risk for getting into the 5%.
Talk a bit, if you will, about the opioid epidemic, the national emergency, if you will, that has been declared by President Trump, and how that fits into your analysis of the system.
Well, you know, there's been two presidents that have declared the opioid crisis a problem, and it is an example of this misaligned system that I talked about. The reason that we're in the opioid problem is because we have been mismanaging pain as a chronic illness. Instead of engaging in the kinds of behaviors that the evidence now shows can both prevent and reverse chronic pain, these are things that American College of Physicians, FDA, CDC, and others have said we should be doing, the non-drug approaches to pain, where there's good evidence of effectiveness, we still continue to push pills. And that's what's gotten us into the opioid crisis. So we have more than an opioid crisis. What we really have is a chronic mismanagement crisis because we have this, you know, late stage acute rescue care medicine where we push pills and we get paid for that. What we need is that we need to train people in developing non-pharmacological approaches. And, you know, I do this in my own practice where I see lots of people with chronic pain, many of whom are on opioids. And I begin to focus on shifting them to things like acupuncture, yoga, behavioral approaches, self-care approaches, such as movement, sleep, et cetera. And then we see the management of their pain improve, and with that, less need for opioids.
What about ADD and ADHD? Many people, when their children are young, begin to give them medications that then have to last for a long period of time. Is that an example of what you're talking about? There's billions and billions of dollars involved in that.
I think it is. And if you go outside of the United States, in the United States especially, you'll see that there are very active and hyperactive kids they're managed in a much different way. They're managed with behavioral programs. They're managed socially. Folks work with the families and the teachers in that. In And they cover that. They pay for that kind of care that's needed. And so the amount of medications that are used in those patients are significantly less. The medications can give you a quick fix, right? They can give you rapid behavioral change. But in some ways, they cover up the underlying problem. Now, that's not to say that they're not useful at times. But again, if we're simply using that, instead of looking at the underlying determinants, the non-drug approaches and the social determinants, like getting kids active and getting them outside and teaching them social and emotional control, which are more complex and they're more effective in the long run for the population and allow us to use less medications.
Just should say in passing that, of course, the United States is, I believe, the only country that allows the advertising of medicines. And, of course, it does that in a big way. And that has created an enormous amount of money and the opportunity to lobby and the possibility of changing the whole system, and such as you suggest, is certainly going to have to come up against that. But in the meantime, what should we shoot for? Where are they doing it better?
Well, I think the point of the advertising is a really important one. You know, the most important problem with that, however, is that it continues to perpetuate this myth that if you want to get help, you go to your doctor, because that's the last thing they say, right? Go to your doctor and get this medication. And that is a myth, as I illustrate in my book. If you want help, you have to actually pay attention to other things. If you want to know how to eat right, move right, sleep right, your doctor wasn't trained in that. I got very little training in nutrition, and we still have poor new training in nutrition. So your doctor actually can't tell you the right things to eat, and it certainly can't help you to do that. In other countries, and this has been studied, this was published in a 2013 National Academy of Medicine report called Shorter Lives, Poor Health, in which they traced 30 years of data in the rich countries in the world, the OECD countries, and the United States was falling off in the vast majority of them compared to other countries. And the reason for that was that other countries were investing less in the medical late-cage rescue approach that I've just described, the 20% part, and investing in the social and the behavioral determinants. So they were putting money into programs that actually educated people about where the determinants of health were, and also were investing in primary care, frontline doctors and healthcare providers, nurses too, to reach out into the community to help people address those social determinants. And when they did that, they saw that the long-term costs were beginning to either go down or not go up as fast as they are in the United States. So there's plenty of models around there and examples of how to do that, and we just need to shift the incentives that we have to those underlying determinants of healing and health.
All right. Just remember that the idea that the thing to do is go to the doctor may be, as Dr. Wayne Jonas describes it, a myth. His book, How Healing Works, Get Well and Stay Well, Using Your Hidden Power to Heal. Dr. Jonas, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This podcast produced by Andrea Brody and Devin Schwartz. Our engineers are Joel Stunn and Mike Newport. I'm Armin Alney. To the Point is available at Apple Podcasts, other platforms, and at kcrw.com/To the Point. Join us again and again and again.